Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the last day of deadline week. I'm going to call this meeting of State Government Finance and Election Committee to order for March 12th, 2021. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting is being held virtually. And would the legislative assistant please take the roll?
Chair Nelson?
I'm here.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Carlson, present.
Representative Nash?
Present.
Representative Bonner?
Present.
Representative Drazkowski? Representative Elkins?
Present.
Representative Greenman?
Present.
Representative Cleborne?
Present.
Representative Kosnick?
Present.
Representative Mason? Representative New Brindley?
Present.
Representative Pulaski? Representative Kwan?
Present.
The quorum is present.
Thank you, Ms. Frick. Next item of business is the approval of minutes from yesterday's meeting on March 11th. Representative Kosnick, did you get a chance to read the minutes?
I have not, sir.
Okay. Representative Carlson, did you get a chance to read the minutes? I can't hear you, Representative Carlson.
Can you hear me now?
Can I hear you now? Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes from March 11th for adoption.
The minutes have been moved. Representative Carlson moved approval of the minutes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. First order of business today is House File 1481, Representative Olson L. Has Representative Mason on yet? No. If not, I'll move the adoption of the division report as posted. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. And with that, I'll move House File 1481 to be referred to the General Register. Representative Olson, explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So House File 1481 is a bill to allow the Duluth Seaway Port Authority to create a nonprofit entity to assist them in carrying out key elements of their mission while effectively managing risk. This bill is before the committee to satisfy the requirement of Minnesota Statute 465.717, which allows for government entities to create a corporation, but only with the authorization of the legislature. As you will hear from my testifier, the Seaway Port is an incredible asset for our state. The Port Authority owns and manages tens of millions of dollars worth of transportation infrastructure on behalf of the state at the Pleur Public Marine Terminal. Meanwhile, the port also has a separate but related mission to engage in economic development and brownfields redevelopment with the goal of bringing business and development to the region and the state. That is the part of the port's mission that this bill seeks to enhance. My testifier today is Jeff Stallenwerk, the Director of Government and Environmental Affairs for the Duluth Seaway Port Authority, and he will provide more information on the port's work and why this proposal is needed. With that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to Mr. Stallenwerk.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, members, and Representative Olson. My name is Jeff Stallenwerk. I am the Director of Government and Environmental Affairs at the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. The Port of Duluth, Port of Duluth Superior is the largest port on the Great Lakes and ranks among the top 20 ports in the United States. The port handles an average of 800 vessels and 35 million tons of maritime cargo each year. As the Duluth Seaway Port Authority works to bring business to the port and economic development to the region, we leverage the unique and valuable transportation assets in the Port of Duluth Superior that are an economic engine for the region and the state. In addition to operating our multimodal logistics hub at the Pleur Public Marine Terminal, The Port Authority has a separate but related mission to engage in brownfields redevelopment. In this area of work, we acquire distressed commercial and industrial properties, which may include unanticipated or unknown liabilities due to physical conditions or the presence of legacy pollutants. The Port Authority brings expertise and financial resources to clean up, restore, and repurpose these brownfields properties. As our brownfields activities grow, we would like to separate the risk associated with this work from our business assets at the Clear Public Marine Terminal. We are also looking ahead to the redevelopment of the U.S. Steel site in the Gary neighborhood of Duluth. It is a big redevelopment project for us, and it will be difficult to get enough public funds to complete. So it is property where it would make sense for us to invite private investment to facilitate that redevelopment. The proposed legislation allows us to create an entity that can collaborate with a private company to complete redevelopment of the U.S. Steel property. There is precedent for government entities to create nonprofit corporations for economic development activities. The most similar to us would be the St. Paul Port Authority, where their business activities extend beyond economic development and include port terminal operations as well. The St. Paul Port Authority created Capital City Properties, which is a nonprofit arm of the SPPA, to support land acquisition, commercial redevelopment, and property management. CCP was created prior to the 1997 legislation that required the legislature's express authorization for a local government unit to create a nonprofit corporation. So in summary, House File 1481 satisfies the requirements of Minnesota Statute Section 465 and allows the Duluth Seaway Port Authority to create a nonprofit corporation that reduces business risk in our economic development efforts and enables us to partner with private companies on our redevelopment projects. Thank you again, Chair Nelson, and I will stand by for questions.
And I don't see any other testifiers on the list. Representative Nash, do we have your hand up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and either to the author or testifier, you just mentioned that creating a not-for-profit would allow you to minimize the risk of redevelopment. What happens if redevelopment uncovers something that surpasses the ability of the not-for-profit to pay for it? Who's on the hook for paying potential mitigation things that might be under the ground that you didn't know about, or if deals go south and the not-for-profit is unable to cover that? Would that be a taxpayer liability, or how does that work?
Mr. Stollenworth.
Chair Nelson, Representative Nash, thank you for that question. The creation of that separate arm doesn't really change. It does not change, ultimate liability who might end up paying for problems if they arise. I think what it does allow us to do is it allows us to avoid the default of bringing in our business assets at the Clear Public Marine Terminal, which are very, very important to supply chains to many of our Minnesota industries and businesses. So it keeps those liabilities separate, but at the same time provides us the time to gather other resources to solve the problem.
And Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe I'll direct this then to Representative Olson. I understand Mr. Stollenworth's answer, but I didn't really hear where liability gets shifted to in his answer. So perhaps Representative Olson could help me with that answer.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just echo what Mr. Stollenworth said, that, I mean, this is the opportunity to be able to do development in actually a less risky way, and to be able to leverage the private and public partnership in a way. So I think he did answer it in the best way possible, and so I don't really have much more to add in that way.
Representative Nash.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to figure out if we move this forward and things go sideways, are the taxpayers going to be on the hook, or who's going to be on the hook? Perhaps Mr. Gehring would know. I hate to impose on him because it's not, I don't know if he drafted this, but I'm just trying to figure out if this not-for-profit is unable to cover all the moving parts, what entity, whose checkbook is this going to come out of?
Mr. Gehring, maybe you can shed some light.
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that. Chelsea Griffin is on the call, and she's worked on this bill more than I have, so she might have some insight.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Griffin. If you can state your name and then proceed with your answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Unfortunately, I'm not sure what the answer would be to your question, Representative Nash, but I could look into it further if you would like.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for members? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was similar questioning on this line in the division. And I believe one of the testifiers, through the questioning, indicated that the state would, because I happened to ask, with the liability going to a nonprofit, if that folds because there's, you know, some liability comes up, you know, is it going to go to the state? And the answer seemed to indicate it would go to the state. I would think that nonpartisan staff would be aware of anything that maybe happened in St. Paul or other situations where there was a industrial site was taken over by a government entity or a nonprofit generated by that government entity. So does that brush the dust off of some bit of information from the nonpartisan staff?
Ms. Griffin?
Mr. Chair, I'm so sorry. I'm relatively new to House research, so the institutional knowledge on this topic, I don't have it yet, but again, I'd be happy to, you know, to look into the question.
I'm seeing this question will probably come up as this goes forward. So I would just hopefully try and get Representative Olson, try and get the answer to that so that you have it, because I know to get asked when this does get to the floor, if it does get to the floor. All members, any other questions? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 1481 be referred to the General Register. All those, Ms. Sprecht, come take the roll, please.
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
No.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski? Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Cleburne?
Aye.
Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative New Brindley?
No.
Representative Pulaski? Representative Quam?
No.
With a vote of 7 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails.
Thank you, members. This bill's not hit the motion prevails, and this bill is now on its way to the General Register. The next bill we have is House File 1947. And again, this is a Representative Olson's bill. I don't see Representative Mason on. Oh, here's Representative Mason. Yeah. Representative Mason, do you want to move the division report?
I move the report.
Representative Mason moves adoption of the division report. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. I'll move House File 1947. I can say my numbers in the right order. to the General Register. Representative Olson, you want to explain your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 1947 is helping the Duluth Economic, or Duluth, sorry, getting my ports in my convention center. So the Duluth Entertainment and Convention Center to have some changes to bring them up to date with some of their enabling language, because the DEC was formed as a state authority in 1963, and it was designed to be an economic engine for northern Minnesota. It has 11 board members, 7 appointed by the mayor and 4 by the governor. The enabling legislation has only been updated once, and that was in 1998. The proposed language in the bill here maintains the original intent of the statute, but updates it to modernize to the business standards and accurately reflect the current operations, which means it's updating the language to be consistent with bylaws. For example, the board president has changed to the board chair, updated gender pronouns to be gender neutral, and updated bid requirements to the amount of $50,000, which is consistent with other like entities. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to my testifier, Roger Reinert, who is the former state senator and current interim director at the Duluth Entertainment and Convention Center.
And before we go to the former senator, I see there's an author's amendment. Does that need to get put on?
Mr. Chair, that was put on in local government, the previous committee.
And that's part of the adoption of the report. I just, it's yep. on my agenda here.
Yep.
Welcome to the committee, former Senator Reinert.
Morning, Mr. Chair.
Introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Good morning, committee. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the time this morning. As Representative Olson mentioned, this effort is to clean up the DEC's enabling legislation. First adopted in 1963, has not been touched since 1998. You'll see that some of the highlights are really administrative, aligning with current DEC operations as well as the bylaws, which were overhauled last year. Changes board president and vice president to chair and vice chair, changes the name of the DEC leadership person from manager to executive, updates the city of Duluth from treasurer to fiscal agent, the board position of secretary to treasurer and or secretary, which reflects board operations, gender-neutral pronouns, updating language to reflect the DEC's marketing efforts, adding language to note that the center is not just the physical complex, because we also have the urban Bayfront operations and the like. And I will just note, it came up in the previous hearing, the board is looking to update. Right now, the state legislation says anything over $2,000, which granted in 1966 was significant, needs to be RFP'd. That's an operational challenge. So the board is looking for the authority to raise that to $50,000, which is comparable with the Port of Duluth, the Airport Authority, and the City of Duluth. I will also note that the board still has the ability, Representative Quam asked this question at the last hearing, to ratchet that down. That would just be the maximum. It's not necessarily what the board may well set a lower level. So with that, I'm happy to stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? I don't see any hands up, but Representative Nash, Representative Nash, you have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, welcome to the committee. Certainly understand that the DEC is an attraction for the city. I guess my only question was, why the move from 2 to 15 to 50 as rapidly as you, and you minimally addressed it just a second ago, but I guess I'm just trying to figure that out. But if you could maybe elucidate on that some, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Ryan.
Representative Nash, Mr. Chair. So initial run through was 2000, doesn't work, almost 60 plus years later. The initial committee just picked 15 as a initial starting point. They then charged me to look at our comparables. Again, that's City of Duluth, the Airport Authority, and the Port Authority. And that gave us the $50,000 number, because that's plus or minus where those three are at. Again, I'm pretty confident the board's not going to go there. It's also trying to anticipate not having to come back to the legislature and ask for that again. So it gives the board the authority to go to that level, but likely set a lower limit, recognizing it's a big increase from 2000, which is where we're at now.
Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for pointing out, I guess, that other entities that are governed by this same statute are at 50. That makes me feel a little bit better. And to the test fire, as an aside, is there perhaps a significant maritime event that's going to be happening in Duluth sometime soon that the deck may be a part of? Maybe you could share some of that for some free advertising.
Representative Reinhart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I appreciate that segue. Yeah, we will, along with the Port of Duluth, be key partners in the commissioning of the new USS Minneapolis-St. Paul LCS 21. Date yet to be determined. It's sliding a little bit to the right, but that'll be the first ship commissioned in the Port of Duluth since World War II. So important for the community, Minneapolis-St. Paul, also the state of Minnesota. So we look forward to seeing all of you there.
And Mr. Chair,
Nash.
In full disclosure, I'm on the commissioning committee along with Roger to get that done. But I figured if he wasn't going to, I would at least do some advertising for the fact that we have a U.S. ship that is going to be named after the two largest cities in our state, commissioned in another very significant city in our state, and would welcome all legislators to come there. And I'm sure Roger will give us a tour of the deck. After we launched this really cool ship, I was able to see it get christened, and it was pretty impressive. But with that, I will stop blathering on about the warship. But as a Navy dad to another Navy guy, go Navy. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Nash is another Navy dad. My son was a submariner, and the submariners claim there are only two types of vessels in the Navy. There are boats, which are submarines, and there are targets.
Targets.
With that, members, any further questions? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 1947 be referred to the General Register. And Ms. Spreck, can you take the roll?
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
Aye.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski? Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Cleborn?
Aye.
Representative Kosnick?
Aye.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative New Brindley?
Aye.
Representative Quam?
Aye.
With a vote of 11 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails. The bill's on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Olson. The next bill we have on the agenda for today, members, is House File 961, and is Chair Eklund here? There he is. Chair Eklund, welcome to the committee. I'll move that House File 961 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's pretty good timing. I just got on. House File 961, I'm going to pull up my notes, Mr. Chair, I apologize. This came from the Environment Committee. The bill allows for state law enforcement supervisors to collectively bargain, which should produce a more efficient process for employees and MMB alike. As of now, state law enforcement supervisors are spread out over three different groups, the commissioner's plan, the managerial plan, and the middle management association. This bill does not mandate that all supervisors organize, but rather creates a bargaining group should their classification group choose to do so. The bill addresses the need for law enforcement to bargain separately, especially supervisors, due to the state law enforcement losing ground over city and county law enforcement equivalents. The bill also allows supervisors to remain competitive with a bargaining group that represents the employees they supervise. Over the past 10 years, supervisors have lost ground and have not been afforded the same benefits as line employees. Excuse me. Lastly, this bill allows for employees to take some control over their future direction and have the opportunity to bargain for an equitable future. I have a couple testifiers, Mr. Chair, and with that, I will leave it to you.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. The list of testifiers, the first person I have is Brian Peters. You want to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I have Brian Peters along for to answer questions, I don't know. I apologize. I should let you know that in advance.
Fine. Then the next person I have on the list is Paul Van Bruis. I just butchered that, but please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
No problem, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My name is Paul Van Bruis. I am currently the president of the Minnesota State Patrol Supervisors Association. I've been a state trooper for over 25 years. I currently serve at the rank of lieutenant in the central Minnesota area. Thank you for the opportunity, Chair Nelson and Representative Eklund, for carrying the bill. What this bill does and why it's so important is in two parts. The first part, as Representative Eklund mentioned, it does clean up a lot of confusion with the current system where state supervisors or state law enforcement supervisors are currently housed. And I'd like to share a screen with the committee just to give you an idea of that confusion, if you will. And what it depicts is, I can get it going. Can you see that okay, Mr. Chair?
Now we can, yep.
Okay, very good. So on the very bottom of this slide, it shows you how the line or the rank and file of state law enforcement officers are organized. These are your entry-level sergeants, if you will, of the state troopers on the left. You have your DNR conservation officers, BCA agents, and then special agents with alcohol gambling, special agents with the Department of Corrections, and the Commerce Division has some sworn special agents as well. All four of those classifications, if you will, belong to the Minnesota Law Enforcement Association, or MLEA. Above each one of those classifications are their respective supervisors, and that is what this bill is particularly talking about or speaking to. On the left, you see above state troopers, you see lieutenants, which is my current rank, captains, and majors. Next to them are the lieutenants of the DNR, and you see a bold line going around those four classifications. They're currently assigned to the commissioner's plan. The commissioner's plan is a plan for severed employees. Within the plan, there are special appendixes that specifically talk about those groups, if you will, but overall lumped into that plan. Above the DNR lieutenants in green are the captains and majors. They are placed into the managerial plan. Likewise, similarly, severed employees in the managerial plan for a variety of unknown reasons. Some are known, some are unknown as you look back in history. But at one point in time back in the mid-80s, those groups elected to sever from organization or bargaining and went into these unorganized plans, if you will. To the right of the DNR are the special agents in charge of the BCA agents. And next to those are the special agents in charge of the Commerce, Corrections, and Alcohol agents. They are currently in Middle Management Association and are organized. What this bill would do would create a new bargaining group for all of those classifications. As Representative Eklund mentioned, there's no intention to force anyone into that group. They would have to go through the process that's defined by the Bureau of Mediation Services and create an authorization from their members, which would require a petition. And there would have to be an election and all of those things that happen when a classification or group organizes. So in addition to cleaning up the differences, I should say the wide disparity, if you will, between managing three different groups and plans, it would place them into one group, which would be efficient. And it also allows these members, if you will, to bargain for items that we are losing ground on. Every 2 years, as you know, we bargain with MMB, and historically, organized groups such as MLEA do better than unorganized groups. And we are sometimes afforded the opportunity to make up that ground in subsequent years. And in other times, we are not given that authority because we don't have the ability to fairly bargain. So this bill will fix that. Recognizing, of course, that you don't win every or get everything that you want in a bargaining session. You know, it's a give and take. But without the ability to do that, we really have no voice. And as you're probably well aware, and the members on the committee, law enforcement in this day and age is a very tumultuous career. And it is sometimes undesirable for people to go into, but the members that I serve, we find nobility in it, and we enjoy the career, and we're in it for life, if you will. So we just want to make it a little bit better for our members. The second point to this bill, as you're aware, during the special session last year, the legislature enacted a 8.4% increase for state troopers, which on the very bottom of the depiction, it was the only group in MLEA that was awarded the 8.4% increase in salary. There's a variety of reasons why. I think everyone's probably well aware that several studies, including the Office of Legislative Auditor, has released studies that have shown that state law enforcement officers are grossly underpaid when compared to their equals around the state. I've heard everything up to 16%. So the 8.4% increase was needed. It was much appreciated by the troopers, as I have a lot of communication with their leadership. What this bill does is it also affords that 8.4% increase to their supervisors. Unfortunately, in that 8.4% increase, we as lieutenants, captains, and majors were not extended that increase. So this bill not only offers that increase to the state patrol supervisors, but it does it across the board, so it's going to fix it. My understanding, there is a bill that is making its way through both houses that also provides that 8.4% increase for the line officers and the conservation, DNR conservation officers, the BC agents, and commerce agents. So if everything goes through with this session, everyone should be made whole, and we truly appreciate the legislature's gracious adjustment to salary. It's going to go a long way for recruitment, and specifically for our group, a long way towards gaining interest from the men and women that are in that rank and file to become the next leaders of the agency. I'm sure everyone's aware it's so important to have great leaders within an organization to move the mission forward. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for any questions.
All members' questions. Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, clarification. Would the pay increase be given if they do not decide to organize?
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam, yes, that is the intention of the bill.
Representative Quam, follow-up.
Basically, I just wanted to make sure it was clear that this is two different things that got put together. I wouldn't quite call it peanut butter and jelly or, you know, any of the other combination we're used to, but this is allowing for a change and not incentivizing that change. It's separately doing the raise. So if that's the correct interpretation, I'll finish, and thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, members, quiet bunch this morning. With that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 961 be...
Here.
Oh, wait a second. There's a Gary... Before I do that, there's a Gary Kluse that wants to testify. I'm sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself. Mr. Kluse, if you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and committee members. My name is Gary Kluse. I am the Executive Director of Middle Management Association. I'm here to talk about House File 961. Part of it I support, and part of it I do not support. I do support officers and everybody getting the 8.4% increase. I know that process is cumbersome. I'm running into that same situation with our lieutenants and captains at our corrections people. The exact same thing happened that the lower level, the Unit 8 AFSCME correction officers received an increase, but they never looked at the people that supervised them. And now we have a major issue there where they're making more money than their supervisor. So I understand, I support that part of the bill all the way. The part I do not support is the starting a new law enforcement supervisor unit. There is a supervisor unit, Unit 16. It became into effect back in probably the late 70s. MMA does represent those people. Our first contract was 1980-81, so we've been representing them for over 40 years. MMA is not a big union compared to your AFSCME and MAPE. You're looking at 14, 15,000 members there. In MMA, we represent about 3,200 members from 54 different state agencies, boards, and commissions. So we have a variety of supervisors with very unique jobs. In MMA, with representation, if somebody is being investigated, we do not use union stewards. A union steward is somebody that is like a fellow employee or an employee working for an agency that's in that union. In MMA, we actually use professionals. We have on board staff. They're called business reps. One has been a labor law attorney for over 20 years. We also have a business rep with close to 20 years of labor relations and HR experience. We also have a labor relations or labor rep that that has over 30 years of labor relations, HR, and worked for the Bureau of Mediation Services as a mediator. And also we have two labor relation or labor law attorneys on retainer. So our members are actually represented with professionals. Also, the representation in the contract is kind of broken up in three different sections. The main section of the contract, that's the section that everybody gets. That's where your benefits are, of your health, your vacation time, sick leave, and all that. Then you have the insurance side of the contract where all the unions negotiate that part of the contract with the state, so every state employee gets that. And the last part, we call it our supplemental. And in that supplemental, there's items that we negotiate for certain members or certain employees in an agency, and it's strictly for them. So what I mean by that is we have supplemental agreements that for bigger bigger agencies, like your corrections, your DOT, your DNR, your Minnesota State, we negotiate items strictly for those people that are employed under those agencies. We also have supplemental agreements for smaller agencies, kind of like Explore Minnesota, your state or the auditor's office, Commerce, and state and public safety. And since we're talking about public safety, under that public safety supplemental, it gets broken down again where the state fire marshal's office has a section in there. We negotiate items strictly for the state fire marshal's office. The next one is the hazard material responders. We negotiate items separately just for those people. Under the BCA, which in the chart showed those two boxes of the different, it would be for the BCA members that is affected, the special agents in charge and the special or assistant special agents in charge, they fall under that. In the MMA contract under public safety and under BCA, we actually negotiate items strictly for those individuals. For instance, they get special they get extra money for availability pay. They get extra money for a clothing allowance. So we actually negotiate specific items right down to the individual job. So every member is looked at and is covered. You may be asking, how do we know what to negotiate? Every year we put out, right now we're starting to gear up for negotiations. We go through the collective bargaining. We send out a survey in January. And of course, there again, the survey was about 38, 39 questions. And it's broken down again. What do you want to see changed in the main contract? What do you want to see changed in the insurance? And then what are you having issues in your agency? What kind of things do we need to bring forward? What, you know, maybe it's a specific thing for your job. Maybe it's you have you feel you're not being paid properly. So it's an inequity. And that's exactly where then we start negotiating with MMB on all this stuff and go through the collective bargaining process. So we are very unique. We have a number of unique positions. We also, in MMA, we push professional development. That is big. We have a conference every year that we put on for our members. We bring in national speakers like Fran Sepler, talk about conflict management and all that. We've even brought in James Burrow to talk about diversity and inclusion. We also have available to our members professional development funds that if they want to attend a conference or some training to better themselves, that is available. That's what the union does for our association. So I do have some concerns with adding a new unit called Law Enforcement Supervisor Unit. You already have a supervisor unit. I'm assuming that these positions that are in the manager's plan and the commissioner's plan, they must be in there for a reason. I'm taking they probably do not have supervisor duties or responsibilities where they cannot hire, fire. They probably cannot hand out discipline. So there's probably a reason. But if they are not doing supervisor duties or responsibilities, I have a hard time adding a new unit called Law Enforcement Supervisor Unit. You already have a supervisor unit, and it's been represented by middle management for the last 40 years. Thank you, Chair Nelson and committee, for allowing me to speak.
I have two people asking questions. Representative Kosnick, I'll go with you first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the committee and the testifiers and interested parties. It seems like there's a little bit of not quite agreement between all the individuals here. I certainly want to support our law enforcement and our troopers, and I think we need a little bit more work. I haven't heard too much in my inbox from different law enforcement on this. So I will be passing today, but I hope that Representative Elkins and those can kind of get a little bit more clarity and agreement. And then hopefully in the next step, we can look to support it. So certainly worthwhile effort, and maybe we can get a little more clarity and consensus and then be able to support it. Thank you.
I think you met Representative Eklund, but Representative Nash, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author or some of the testifiers, Mr. Kloos just brought up that and voiced the concern that I'm having that somebody is being added to a supervisory role that isn't truly a supervisor. And I'm just trying to figure out the rationale behind that. And I hope that all the testifiers and supporters know. I mean, I'm not sure you get more pro-cop than me, but I'm just trying to figure out what is the rationale behind this and how did we arrive at this, particularly when MMA is already apparently representing the people in the middle management level. So I'd just like a little more detail, if I could, please.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Nash. Well, this came about working with management and budget others when we were developing the amendment that was heard in the Labor Committee. But basically what it is the two groups, the two main groups are in the commissioner's plan right now. And some of the other ones, just by definition, as whether they're supervisors or not, the supervisor is in their title. And so that's why some of those were included. I want to make it clear the ones that are in the MMA plan can stay in that plan. We're not, there would be no requirement that they move to this new bargaining unit. And I talked to Mr. Kloos and others yesterday. They were going to offer me language that I'm looking forward to seeing to see if we can make that any more clear. With that, Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I will yield to Mr. Peters from the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association that he may give you a more explicit answer.
Mr. Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. My name is Brian Peters. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. We represent over 10,000 law enforcement agents across the state, to include Mr. Van Boris's group. Chair, Representative Nash, can you repeat your question, please?
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Peters. The question is, I'm trying to effectively ask the question of what appears to be a duplicative effort. And then for people who are not truly supervisors, according to Mr. Kloos, being included in a new bargaining unit for the supervisory folk. I'm just trying to make sense of this. And you and I talk regularly, and you know how much I support the effort of our law enforcement officers. I'm just trying to make sense of this because it's a little confusing, and I'm just trying to gain some clarity.
Mr. Peters.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. You know, being new to my position going on 2 years here, I've certainly learned a lot about the bargaining process when it comes to state agencies. And the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. The reason why troopers and these state agencies have fallen so far behind over a number of years is the lack of bargaining, specifically here with the troopers. They really don't have a choice in the matter. They're given what maybe a snowplow truck driver is given for an increase each year. And that doesn't take away from the importance of the people that plow our roads. However, law enforcement, I see a little bit different. Law enforcement has changed a great deal over the last 2 years. The troopers, the DNR, many other state agencies have been holding the line in areas like Minneapolis up at the Line 3. And we feel that it's important that they have some control over their future. And I believe that MMA and MMB have not done a good job at all looking at this profession and putting them in a different category. So what I believe strongly in is that this allows the state troopers and other state supervisors groups to be able to have a little bit more influence on what they're bargaining with each year.
Representative Nash.
I'm good, I guess. Thank you.
And members, notes been given to me that this needs to go and not to Ways and Means, but to Environment, because of the DNR officers involved. So members, I'll be changing my motion when we get to that point. Is there any other questions? Mr. Kloos, I see you got your hand up. You want to say?
Yeah, I want to say something that and respond to the testimony by Peterson that MMA has not done a properly good job of representing our members. We actually, if you look, the members we represent, those people in that BCA, we negotiate right to them. They're not a group. We're negotiating right to the specific job. So when they say that we're not doing a very good job of representing them, we're actually representing them right to the job classification, right down to the member. How much more representation do you need? I mean, you're right to the individual. So I disagree with what he has said there.
Chair Nelson, am I able to respond to that?
Mr. Peters and Representative, and Mr. Peters and Mr. Kloos, I would think I would, as this is going to Ways and Means, excuse me, this is going to Environment, I would hope that we could get a meeting with you and Representative Eklund and try and work, get some of this stuff worked out. We're not going to have back and forth between testifiers. We're here to get answers, and we're here to move the bill on. Representative Koznick, you put your hand up.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the amended recommendation or movement of the bill to Environment to have some of the issues worked out. That hopefully we can get some more consensus and a little bit more information so we can help them out and figure this out. So I appreciate that move, and that's the end of my question or statement.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the various law enforcement representation here, and to Representative Eklund, obviously there is some confusion and some disagreement going on here. I know that the chair is changing his recommendation to go to Environment so it can catch the DNR officers as well, I believe, Mr. Chair.
Correct.
I would ask if you would be kind enough to maybe all set up a time with me as well. I'm concerned at the conflicting information I'm getting here, and I certainly support law enforcement, but I want to make sure that we're doing a little bit more detailed and a deeper dive that really can't be done in committee here. So if you would include me in that, I will vote to move the bill along, but I'm going to ask for a greater level of involvement and interaction so that we can tell our members, who are obviously going to be pro-law enforcement but feel conflicted when two law enforcement organizing units go after each other, for lack of a better term. So would ask if I can get your commitment to do that, Representative.
Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nash said I'd be happy to do that. I know that all bills are a work in progress till they make it to the House floor, and then even then they might be a work in progress. So let's have that conversation, and I extended that to Mr. Kloos yesterday as far as finding the language would satisfy their concerns.
Any further questions? If not, Representative Eklund, you want to just wrap up, and then we'll get to the vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I appreciate your patience in listening to this bill. I think it's a good bill, especially dealing with those folks in law enforcement supervisor ranks that are in the commissioner's plan. It'll help get them so that they are on equal footing or approach equal footing with their brothers and sisters in the city and county and other municipal units. So thank you, Mr. Chair, I ask for your support on the bill.
And Representative and Chair Eklund, as I said, hopefully that you can get the groups together and discuss it and work out, have them try and work out their differences so that we can get the peace in the valley we like to have on the bills before they go to the floor. With that, Representative Eklund, I'll renew my motion that House File, or I'll amend my motion that House File 961 be referred to the Environment Committee. Members, Ms. Sprecht, will take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
Aye.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski?
No.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Cleborn?
Aye.
Representative Koznick?
Aye.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative New Brindley?
Aye.
Representative Pulowski?
Pulowski, aye.
Representative Quam?
Aye.
With a vote of 12 ayes and 1 nay, the motion prevails.
Motion prevails. You're on your way to Environment Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
I'm going to hand the virtual gavel over to Vice Chair Carlson because the next two bills are my bills. Representative
Chair Nelson. Thank you, Chair Nelson. The next bill on the agenda is House File 2173. Chair Nelson, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move House File 2173 to be before the committee. And I, if we get to at the end, we will talk about it. And then I'll have another motion at the end. Representative, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Chair Nelson, I see we also have an author's amendment. Would you like to proceed with the A1 amendment?
I'd like to move the A1 amendment, and this is just a clarifying it, and Mr. Sigurdsson can explain it, and if anybody has questions.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the executive director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. The amendment just clarifies that a certain amount of information from the lobbyists and the lobbyist disbursement report has to be reported on both reports. The prior requirement is that it was only reported on the June 15th or one of the two reports. So this is changing it so that the information is reported on both disbursement reports.
Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. Are there any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing no questions on the A1 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say no. The A1 amendment has been adopted. Chair Nelson, to your bill.
All members,
this is to testifiers.
First, Mr. Chair, members, this bill was brought to me by the Campaign Finance Board. It's some changes in how they deal with lobbyists. And as this bill came in, and the bill came in late because for some reason the jackets were sent and the jackets got lost and they didn't get replacement jackets till late in the game. And so there's because of that, there's been some concerns about this bill. I know there's Mr. Heller has raised some concerns about the lateness of the bill and the lateness of it being posted. Some of that's what happens this time of the year at deadline. But this was more that the bills got the jackets got misplaced in both the House and the Senate. We couldn't find them to get them dropped in. And so that's why it came in late. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Sigurdsson to explain the bill. And I know we have two people that want to speak on the bill also. So with that, I'll turn it over to the testifiers.
Very good. Thank you, Chair Nelson. Mr. Sigurdsson, if you could proceed with your testimony. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, members. Again, my name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the executive director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I know that this bill is a little hard to take out of context, so I'm going to give just a brief overview of what the board is thinking here and then try to move through the major provisions fairly quickly. The background here is, of course, that the board provides three major programs in terms of disclosure to the public. The campaign finance program, which, of course, you're all very aware of. The economic interest statement program for conflict of interest, which, again, you need to complete and you're very aware of. And then the third program is that the board administers the registration and reporting of lobbyists in the state. And the board is always evaluating these programs to see if, frankly, there's good government. And by good government, I mean that when taxpayers are providing funding for these programs, that the type of disclosure that is being produced by the program is meaningful and that there is some value to it rather than just a bureaucratic procedure where paper is shifted back and forth. We want to make sure that the program makes some sense. And over the evaluation of the last couple of years, the board believes that there are some significant issues with the type of reporting that's being provided through the lobbying provisions in Chapter 10A. I want to emphasize that this is not at all a way of trying to limit lobbying. There's nothing in here that limits the associations in terms of the number of lobbyists that they can have, the amount that they spend on lobbying, the source of funding. None of that is affected by this legislation. This is, again, just trying to make sure that we have meaningful disclosure because, in the end, we're trying to get disclosure from the board's perspective that helps build confidence in government, whether it be, again, for campaign finance, economic interest, or the lobbying program. It's building confidence in the public that the governmental actions taken on their behalf, they understand what's going on. The two, and I did also want to stop and to acknowledge that the Minnesota Government Relations Council, the NGRC, has been an important partner in this process. The first draft of this legislation, which was never, proposal, I should say, from the board, was never presented to the legislature because we knew it was a draft. We wanted to get the response of the NGRC, who represents a large number of lobbyists, and to make sure that we had something here that would not be so burdensome that it would inhibit their ability to, you know, to carry out their function lobbying. And I think that there has been a lot of progress made in that. The first version of this 2 years ago looked at percentages and had a lot of detail, which frankly was a distraction and became a very, from the lobbyist perspective, and I think convincingly so, would have been unnecessary and wouldn't have advanced the goal that the board has here. And so we've reduced that. Interacting with the NGRC has helped me reduce some of my worst bureaucratic tendencies and cleaned up the legislation so that we're focusing on what we believe are the important things. First is the, maybe I should also say that there's really two problems that we think that the lobbying program currently has. First, lobbyists do report. They report twice a year their lobbyist disbursements, but the information provided in those reports is focusing on the administrative costs related to lobbying. For example, office space cost or cell phone cost, or there's actually a reference in statute to their telegraph costs. I mean, it's going down and trying to determine somehow that we're going to get important information on lobbying by understanding how much they're spending on these support costs for their lobbying effort. If you stop to think about that, I'm not sure exactly what you can get from that type of information. Even if you understand somebody's cell phone bill, does that really understand or help you understand the organization that's being represented by the lobbyist? There are over 1,400 associations in Minnesota that are represented by lobbyists that have hired lobbyists. And understanding their cell phone costs or any other administrative costs related to their lobbying effort in Minnesota doesn't provide the type of disclosure that we believe forwards, the public's understanding of Minnesota government. The second problem that we think we have is that I think everyone's aware that you register as a lobbyist if you're going to be lobbying the legislature. The current statute also says you need to register as a lobbyist if you're going to be lobbying administrative lobbying, which is when a state agency adopts administrative rules, or when you're going to be lobbying a metropolitan governmental unit, which is defined for our purposes as the seven counties, but also any city of over 50,000 and entities like the Metropolitan Council and the MAC. So if you're lobbying those type of entities, again, you're supposed to register with the board. And yet, there is virtually no information in our register of lobbyists and the reports that they provide that we can provide you on that. How much was spent on lobbying metropolitan governmental units? We can't tell you because that information isn't provided. How much about state agencies? Again, we can't provide you. We can't even tell you which of those 1,400 entities were interested in administrative rules or the actions of metropolitan governmental units. So this proposal shifts the focus. It goes away from administrative costs. It deletes those requirements that lobbyists track those and report those, and instead moves to a program where we're looking at the subjects of interest of the association represented and provide additional detail on the type of lobbying that's provided or that occurs for metropolitan governmental units and state agencies. There's probably a couple of terms, and I know this is a little bit, I'm going to tie it into the sections so that if there are questions on the particular sections of the bill, again, maybe the overview will explain what's going on there. In sections 2 and 9, we're trying to define two levels of identifying the topics that the lobbyists are working on. They both deal with what's called the general lobbying category. And this, you might say, is the 30,000-foot level of information on what the association is interested in. We're talking about things like education, energy, healthcare, big topics that the lobbyist identifies when they register for the association. They are currently doing something similar to that already. But the problem is that in our current statute, there's no limit on what they put in there. So if you put, what they identify as their main concerns for the association. So in our database, we have well over 2,000 distinct subjects. Again, if you think about this in terms of getting information that you can then access or provide to the public, 2,000 subjects means it's impossible to index anything. You can't really look up energy because there are 40 different variations of energy that's provided when the lobbyist registered. So this is going to create a list, a much, instead of 2,000, we hope to work with the MGRC and the rest of the lobbying community and come up with a list of 50 or 60, I don't have a magic number, but a relatively small number of these large topics, which we're going to say, okay, you're going to be looking at energy or education, and then they'll provide that when they register. When you then go from there, we have a second level, which is the specific subjects of interest. And that's, again, underneath the general category, you would be looking at, and sometimes this is easiest if I explain it with examples. If you registered with energy, well, then when you go to report, we're looking for specific subjects of interest that you worked on during that last reporting period. Remember, all reports, of course, are retrospective, that you worked on. So you, under energy, you might have percentage of energy that's from renewable energy sources, or you might have setback from public highways for wind turbines. If it's education, maybe it's per student payment from the state, charter school, teacher certification, testing standards. I think you can kind of see what we're doing here. We're starting at kind of a large topic, and then so that we have meaningful information, we want to say within a sentence, we're not looking for paragraphs, we're not looking for a book here, but within a sentence, you're going to provide more detail on the specific subject within that larger subject that you were representing the association on at the last legislative session or, again, Metropolitan Government Unit, whatever type of lobbying you're doing. That's in Section 6, by the way, of the bill. So how do the lobbyists determine what to report? And this was something, again, we worked with a lot with the NGRC, and I think they provided us with a lot of good perspective on what's realistic. The initial approach, frankly, probably would have resulted in them tracking their time, much like an attorney does, every 15 minutes saying I was doing this or that. And that was the type of burden that the board didn't want to impose, that was not interested in. And so really, we went back to the same standard that the current statute used. And the current statute really requires the lobbyist to use a reasonable good faith effort to determine what was the major subjects that they represented that entity on. Remember, this is in retrospect. We're in a way, we're kind of developing a standard, if you think about it, that you would do maybe with your boss. You know, when you do a review at the end of a year, the boss may say to you or your supervisor may say to you, what were the four most important things you did for us this year? And that's where you would list those.
Mr. Sigerson, we're coming up on quite a bit of time here for explaining the bill. If you could, wrap it up in the next 2 minutes, so we really appreciate it, so we can get to our other testifiers.
Certainly. So at any rate, that's the standard, is the good faith effort. So in legislative lobbying, then you have basically listing the general lobbying category and then the four, and no more than four specific subjects underneath that. If there's more than four, then you work in consultation with the association to identify the four most important ones for you. With the Public Utilities Commission, which is now broken out as a new type of lobbying, you list for the entity that you represent every single project name. The PUC, with all their docket numbers, they assign a project name, which is a lot easier to follow, and you would simply list all of those. With administrative lobbying, again, the example being, you know, maybe this makes more sense if you have an example. The Pollution Control Agency is now entering in rulemaking for air emission standards. If you're representing an association that's going to be lobbying on that area or is concerned on that area and trying to influence those administrative rules, you would list Pollution Control Agency and you would say, air emission standards.
Mr. Sigerson, please stick around for questions, but if you have some closing comments on describing the bill, that would be helpful so we can get to our other testifiers.
Okay. Again, I guess the last thing I say is that the Metropolitan Council, you would provide the city or the MAC or the Metropolitan Council, and then you would list, again, the subject area. So it might be for St. Paul, the future of the Ford plant, or things like that. So again, for the first time, there's information to the public on the subjects of the association, and then for Metropolitan and administrative and PUC lobbying, for the first time, you have the specific subjects of interest for the association. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Severson. And please stick around for questions. Remaining testifiers, we have three more testifiers. We also have another bill up for today. Testifiers, if you can please be succinct with your prepared remarks. That would be much appreciated. Next, I have Jeremy Esterson next on the agenda to testify. Mr. Esterson. Estenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jeremy Estenson. I'm the immediate past president of the Minnesota Government Relations Council, and I'm a registered lobbyist employed by the Stinson Law Firm. With me today is Mr. Eric Hyland, who serves as our counsel, and he is here today to provide technical expertise and pinch hit in the event that I can't answer a question. We appreciate the opportunity to provide our thoughts on the bill and the issue of lobbyist disclosure. Well, you're probably familiar with our members. The MGRC as a whole is a trade organization of Minnesota lobbyists, about 550 members. Our goal is to provide professional development and enhanced working experiences inside and outside of the Capitol. We also advocate for the profession when the occasion arises. The Campaign Finance Board first engaged, as Mr. Sigurdsson said, about 18 months ago on this issue. And at that time, the Campaign Finance Board looked proposal looked a lot different than it does now, and we certainly appreciate the work that Mr. Sigurdsson, the board, and his staff have done to address our feedback. However, our board continues to have some concerns as we have gone back and forth with the board, attended their meetings, presented in front of their meetings, and so forth. Some of those concerns are the following. One, what problem are we trying to solve? And we've communicated this to Mr. Sigurdsson. Typically, regulators make sweeping changes like these when there's a pervasive or a severe problem. We're unaware of either one, but nonetheless, we support building on the already high level of disclosure regulations that lobbyists in Minnesota comply with, so long as any changes are meaningful and workable. Mr. Chair, well, we are the regulated community, and our opinion on how we ought to be regulated is probably not paramount to the regulator. We're also probably the chief consumer of information produced by the Campaign Finance Board in this regard, and we have some ideas and concerns that we hope the Campaign Finance Board will address as we move forward. With more meaningful disclosure for the public consumption as a backdrop, here are a few of our thoughts. Mr. Chair, the website is far less user-friendly than it used to be. We would support improvements to the website that help people find the already plentiful information currently disclosed. And would these changes actually create a better picture? Who are these changes targeted at? Mr. Chair, the line between activists and lobbyists is blurred over the years. We hope that the Campaign Finance Board would take some time to consider the population advocating at the Capitol and what the line between unregulated and regulated lobbyists ought to be. And finally, Mr. Chair, one that's come up recently is the issue of privacy. Many lobbyists run their shops up from their homes, and that means their address is listed on the Campaign Finance website. Given the changes in the way certain groups have engaged in advocacy, particularly recently, we would like the opportunity to modify what data is public. In short, Mr. Chair, while there absolutely have been improvements in the proposal from our perspective, there's still a lot of work to do to understand the implications of these significant changes to the reporting regimen. Our members are compliance-driven, and we take our reporting responsibilities very seriously. Mr. Chair, given the direction that I believe the conversation is going to go in the future motion that Chair Nelson is going to make, I'd be happy to walk through some of our specific concerns in the language, but I'll defer to you if you'd prefer to save time and let the committee ask questions.
Thank you, Mr. Esterson. We do have plenty of time, but I think for now, if those are your opening remarks, we can get to our next testifier. Next, I have Mr. Eric Hyland.
Mr. Chairman, members, as Jeremy said, I'm Eric Hyland of Eric Hyland Government Relations. I do represent the MGRC and are simply here to answer any questions the members have. Jeremy did an excellent job of kind of outlining our concerns with the proposal that's currently written. Thank you.
Wonderful. Next on my list of testifiers, Mr. Rick Heller. And Mr. Heller, if you could please keep your comments to the bill before us, that would be appreciated. Mr. Heller.
Yes, you can hear me, correct?
We can hear you.
My name is Rick Heller. I unofficially represent the Twice Exceptional and Print Disabled, also known as Twice Eligible, Minnesota Statute 120B15, testifying today on House File 2173. My experience with the campaign finance report and using the webpage accessibility, I had some suggestions based on some of the language in the bill at 4131 through 32 and 5154. It's up to the chair to anyone's going to answer any questions or provide feedback, as the bill doesn't allow for public feedback. It does allow for public feedback, but it doesn't allow for rule writing. It's my understanding. I do agree with classifying lobbying categories. I would ask, since they're going to provide public feedback, this is my opportunity that they, when they evaluate the reports and create downsize and index better with what lobbyists do, that they would look at web content accessibility guidelines, something that they try to practice there, and that when documents are created or reports are created, that somehow they, in the PDF metadata, you can add keywords as to that. They could create a porthole to port the stuff into more an accessible format, searchable. Just like Jeremy said, the website could be more friendly. If this group got together and worked on the categories, I ask that they evaluate those processes about how about the people that create the documents and send them that if they're in PDFs, that they actually fill out the metadata, what specific areas they're going to focus on. So what that does is, if anybody knows it, but the search engine searches the document properties of PDFs, and it's friendlier and usable for people to find important information. Now, the other piece they mentioned about addresses, yes, there's addresses of people on there. However, it's my understanding that there's only going to be one contact person now with lobbyists too. And so I don't know about addresses being down there, but they can still use their business address. I don't know if they're required to put their personal address down. But unless they had a disclosure about what information you can provide that's accurate, as long as it's a PO box, you know, it's up to those individuals to consider that too. So that's important feedback that I have regarding this. I do thank Mr. Nelson for getting this bill appropriate and getting up the summary on this as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. That's all the testifiers I have listed, so we can move to member questions.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, Chair Nelson.
Mr. Chair and members, as this bill is confirming, like I said, it came late, and I apologize to Mr. Heller. I know he was a little had some concerns about the fact that it came late and it wasn't posted, and that's because of the issue with the jackets being misplaced, to having to get new jackets made for it. Members, this bill needs a lot more work, I think, and I think I'm going to charge the lobbyist group and Mr. Sigurdsson to work on this in the interim. I had a message from our Senator Kiffmeyer that she's not going to hear the bill this year, so it's not going to get done. So I think that they need to sit down and work on this bill more. And I know this has been difficult in the time of COVID to do this, but to get together and work on this and try and work out the differences and try and figure out what works best. And also take Mr. Heller's suggestions into effect that about making the website more easily readable, an easier website. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. But with that, members, I'm going to move that we lay this bill on the table and have the campaign finance board and the M's and the lobbyist group to work on it in the interim and bring this back.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. I have two members that have questions. Should members, if you could direct those questions to the individual, since we're just, okay, I've seen heads nod. So work with the testifiers, work with the bill author in the interim. Okay, great. So with that, let's see here. Let me get the House file number again here. So with that, Chair Nelson moves that House File 2173 be laid on the table. Members, the last bill on the agenda for today is House File 16.
Mr. Chair, we need to vote on that.
Oh, we need to vote on. I'm sorry. See, I'm already getting ahead of myself. And there's Sydney waving at me. See, I even missed that. Ms. Spreck, if you would please take the roll.
Can this one be a voice vote?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we can do all those in favor of laying House File 2173 on the table, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. House File 2173 is laid on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for your indulgence, members. Thank you for your patience on that. Last on the agenda today is House File 1671. Chair Nelson, this is also your bill. And if we can adopt the division report, I think is the first thing we need to do on this.
Chair Mason still here?
I am. I move that House File 1671 be adopted from local gov division.
Representative Mason, you kind of cut off on me, but I'm assuming that you...
I moved adoption.
Thank you. Moved adoption of the division report. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. The division report is adopted. And then, Chair Nelson, to your bill, House File 1671, be referred to the General Register. Chair Nelson, to your bill.
I'll move that House File 1671 be referred to the General Register. And members, this bill is about contracting and at the county level. In the previous years, we've set up a carve out for the counties to be able to do smaller contracts with DBEs, businesses, small businesses, and veteran-owned businesses to try and allow these smaller businesses and these disadvantaged businesses to be able to grow and learn how to contract with the state and or with the county and learn the ins and outs of working with the government and try and give these businesses a way to grow and to get bigger. And all that we're doing in this bill is raising the level, the cap on what the county can do this at from $250,000 to $750,000. And I have Michael Rosenfeld here from the Hennepin County to explain the bill. And I'd like to turn it over to him.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair Nelson. Mr. Rosenfeld, if you would introduce yourself and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Michael Rosenfeld. I'm the manager of negotiated procurement in the purchasing department of Hennepin County. As Representative Nelson just explained, this legislation will enable counties to increase their contracting with small businesses, which has been a priority for Hennepin County. During the last 5 years, Hennepin County has been focused on offering contract opportunities to small businesses, particularly in the sector of construction and professional services. We've established several programs to promote those objectives. I'd like to describe how this legislation would have a significant and positive impact on counties' efforts to offer contract opportunities to small building contractors. Our experience with three programs that we created for small construction firms, I think, really would illustrate the positive impact of the bill. Hennepin County created a program several years ago for small residential remodelers to rehabilitate tax-forfeited houses. We followed that up with programs for commercial contractors to repair, small repair and remodeling projects in county facilities. We marketed those programs to all small construction firms that were certified as small businesses by the certification program that the county relies on. That's a small business certification program that is available for all businesses within a 15-county region. Each of those programs was oversubscribed by interested small contractors. We received more applications than available spots. As a result, we had to administer lotteries, public lotteries, to select businesses to participate in the program. In fact, last year, when we added three more spots to one of the programs, 19 small businesses applied for that. So again, we had to conduct a public lottery. I mention that because that is a reflection of the high level of interest that small businesses have in working for counties. After the legislature increased the amount that that counties can directly bid to small businesses in 2018 from $100,000 to $250,000, our spending with these small commercial building contractors tripled in the next year. So in 2018, we went from $429,000 to $1.2 million. That outcome highlights the correlation between the statutory authority, the statutory limit on a county's ability to directly bid to small businesses, and the amount of business counties can direct through competitive bidding to small businesses. This legislation is important for counties because it will allow counties to offer small businesses more typically sized county projects. I think the best example to illustrate that point would be, again, with remodeling projects. $250,000 does not purchase much scope in today's construction market. Under the current law, if we want to offer small businesses the opportunity to bid on a typical remodeling project in a county building, we have to unbundle a small portion of a larger project and separately bid it to small contractors to deliver that portion of the larger project. So a typical example with $250,000 as our limit in terms of the estimated cost of that work, that might represent a quarter of a floor of a building, and then the remainder of that floor would be remodeled by a larger contractor, a larger company that won the bid through being publicly advertised to all firms. What our experience has shown is that smaller contractors are capable of doing much more than the small work that we've been able to offer them under the current authority. And so what is preventing counties from being able to offer larger contracts to small businesses is the current limitation in the statute that this bill amends. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions you or the members of the committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenfeld. Appreciate your testimony today. Those are all of the signed up testifiers. I think there are others available for questions, including Mr. Peterson. Mr. Peterson, I have a note here that you're just here to answer questions if called upon. Assuming that's the case, speak up if not.
Mr. Chairman, Kirk Peterson with Hennepin County. I'm just here to answer questions. We did have one other testifier, Mike Hickey, with the National Federation of Independent Businesses, that was prepared to testify in support of this. He's on another call, but he asked me to relay that message.
Okay, appreciate it. Thank you. With that, we can move to member questions. First on my list is Representative Quam. Representative Quam, if you would proceed with your question, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And previously, I'd asked for sort of an information. We've had a background of some of the projects and et cetera, but when you're moving it double, triple, I had asked about how many additional projects in recent history were there, and if you went up to, doubling it, and then how much greater would be if you tripled it, and that would give us some context to how far to change it. And so I hadn't seen anything, but it's been busy times, and I didn't know if the Mr. Rosenfeld had some information on that.
Mr. Rosenfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'm not sure if a chart that we had prepared that was responsive to the representative's question was circulated, but I would be happy to answer the question directly. In 2018, as mentioned, we had spent under this program, we had awarded 12 contracts to small businesses for $429,000. Had we this authority, had we been able to offer the contracts that were between 250,000 to 750,000, in other words, the next increment that would be authorized under this bill, by this bill, we would have awarded 12 more contracts to small businesses and the total for an additional $5.385 million. That would have represented 21% of our commercial contracts awarded that year, with another $20 million continuing to be delivered by larger companies. The next year, in 2019, where we had awarded 16 contracts for $1.1 million, had we this authority, we would have awarded an additional 13 contracts for $6.085 million. And that would have represented about 15% of our total awards. So that is indicative of the additional business that we would have been able to offer to small businesses. And we're confident they would have performed those contracts well. It's important to note that the law requires that these contractors be bonded for this work. So we don't feel that there's any undue risk associated with offering an opportunity to a small business. We frankly feel that there is greater capacity in the marketplace than what we are able to access under the current law. And we feel that this bill would create more balance and would allow us to offer opportunities of a scale that these small businesses are well capable of delivering.
Mr. Patterson, you had a comment to the question as well.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kwan, this is my fault. Michael Rosenfeld did prepare another spreadsheet on that. I wasn't able to get that to staff in time, but I will send that to you directly, and I will send that to committee staff if the chair wants to provide that on the record.
If you could share that with staff, then they can disperse that to the other members. Thank you.
Will do. Yep.
Representative Kwan, did you have a follow-up?
I just want to say that helps us have an idea of the scale, and just a yes or no clarifier on this allows the capability but does not constrain an entity to only using these types of businesses. In other words, if you have a project that isn't, you know, multimillion dollars but requires a certain specialization that or might not quite be addressed by companies. You understand what I'm saying about, and that clarification with this makes it much easier to support.
Thank you, Representative Kwan. The other two members I have with questions are Representative Draskowski and Representative Nash. I have a question as well, but if you guys want, since you're the last two leads on the bill, incorporate your questions as well as your kind of closing comments, that would be appreciated. Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a question for Mr. Rosenfeld or Mr. Peterson. I'm just reading, this current law says this can be done if you have a certified small business enterprise by a county designated small business certification program. I can't remember which county, I'm guessing, was it Hennepin County? Can you tell us what is a small business according to your small business certification program in your county?
Mr. Rosen.
Hennepin County relies on a program, it's referred to as the CERT program. It certifies all small businesses based on the Small Business Administration's definition of a small business. So the SBA, every 5 years, promulgates size standards for all businesses in all industry codes, and that is the basis on which the certification program defines eligibility. That happens to be the same size standard that the state uses for its small business certification programs.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Rosenfeld, under your example of somebody remodeling that one floor of that apartment building or whatever kind of building it was, what would be a small business? 20 employees, 2 employees, under your program?
Mr. Rosenfeld.
Representative, The small business size standards are based on the annual gross receipts of the business rather than the size, rather than the number of employees. The only businesses that are defined by number of employees are manufacturers, at least by the Small Business Administration. So the size standards are based on annual gross receipts, and the CERT program that we rely on uses a three-year average of annual gross receipts. So basically the sales of the business.
So Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Rosenfeld, what is that amount?
Mr. Rosenfeld.
Representative, the amount differs by industry. So with the example that I cited of in commercial construction, the size standard for a general contractor doing commercial work is 39.5 million. The size standard for a specialty contractor, such as an electrical contractor, plumbing, mechanical, et cetera, would be 16 million annual sales. Those are the SBA size standards for those industry codes.
So Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rosenfeld. Mr. Rosenfeld, that doesn't sound like a small business where I come from. I don't know that that met my perception of what a small business was. And one more question, Mr. Chair, and that is Mr. Rosenfeld, is there anything limiting if, you want the ceiling to be $750,000 in this bill, which is a large contract in my mind, but is there anything limiting? Should this not change? And you were talking about bumping up against kind of those limits you're experiencing with this group of businesses that you're employing through these contracts. Is there anything limiting them from participating in the normal bidding process? Do they have the capacity to bid normally like any other contractor does?
Mr. Rosenfeld.
Representative, of course, they're free to, there are no limitations on who can bid on a publicly advertised opportunity. I think that what motivated the creation of this program is a recognition that these smaller businesses really have some inherent disadvantages when they're competing against larger companies, particularly for contracts that are awarded solely on the basis of price. These programs were created through this authority, really to reflect a remedy, if you will, to try to create some balance, and to the extent that it allows for competitive bidding among like-sized businesses, that's more representative. That offers the opportunity to have a level playing field among smaller firms competing against smaller firms. As to your comment about the size standard being seeming quite large, we agree with that. We have set size standards for emerging small businesses, which would be a subset of that, so as to be able to offer the opportunity to small businesses that really are more reflective of the businesses in our marketplace, as opposed to a definition that's based on national data that really is not descriptive of the businesses in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenfeld.
Mr. Chair, can I close up?
Mr. Chair, can I add to the answer?
Chair Nelson wants to comment on the question, and then Representative Joskowski will get back to you. Chair Nelson.
Thank you. I'll lower my hand here. No, as the construction industry, and part of what this does is help these smaller contractors compete against the big ones. Sometimes when the work level is down, the economy is in a recession, the big contractors will come in and swoop up all these small contracts because they have larger bankrolls and they can afford to at times bid these jobs at a loss and so that they can keep their people working. And it tends to then, and when that happens, it tends to push these smaller businesses out of the market and basically put them under at times. This program helps the counties be able to keep some of these small businesses, some of that work set aside just for those small businesses, So they're competing against people of like size and not the huge, I'm going to say some names, Mortensen, Carl Sandersons that we have, but some of the smaller contractors out there can bid on these jobs and get these jobs and actually grow and survive during bad times. So that this also helps those people.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. And Representative Drazkowski, one final comment.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson for the bill. You know, I hear the testimony, and we allow in law the ability for the county or the other municipality or whoever we're talking about here to be able to describe in their own eyes what a small business is. I mean, they could, the way the law reads, it looks to me, I mean, they referenced the U.S. Small Business Administration. It sounds like they got a subset of those carved out somehow. I don't know exactly what that looks like. But, you know, we are leaving that wide open to the counties here or the cities. And I don't know. I struggle with the loosey-goosey effect, approach to this law to begin with. And that has really not a lot to do with the bill, Mr. Chair. But I don't see where these small businesses, if you're a $39 million small business or $15 million in annual sales, you don't have the ability to get out there and put bids in. This seems to me to be more of a convenience for the government less work for them. And certainly they're going to like that because it's much easier for them. But maybe we're relaxing the protections for the taxpayer in that. I plan to vote no. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Representative Bonner.
Thank you. I'll be brief. You know, really, I just wanted to thank Representative Nelson for bringing this forward. You know, I've attended lots of events with NIDA and organizations, particularly minority small-owned businesses, who have said repeatedly they just want the opportunity to compete. They want the opportunity to show the quality and the value that they can deliver for the state. And that's really what they're asking for. And so I really appreciate this bill in that it really is a first step in helping ensure that some of those smaller competitors that can deliver incredible value really have the opportunity to step up and prove that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Bonner, for your comments. Next. Sorry, folks, I got a lot of screens opened up here. 1 second. Next on my list, Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins, if you have a question, please proceed.
Yeah, no. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to kind of build on a comment that Chair Nelson made a second ago. You know, one of the things that I've observed in overseeing contracts when I was a member of the Met Council is that in many cases, you know, small businesses usually only have opportunities to be subcontractors to large businesses on projects. And one of the problems that creates for small businesses is that when they are a subcontractor or a sub of a sub, they get paid really slowly. And by being able to bid on more contracts directly where they can be the prime contractor, it really, really helps them with their cash flow and their ability to grow their businesses. So I think I for that reason, I really strongly support this proposal as well.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. I kind of cut off there a little bit for me at the end. I heard, I didn't catch a question there. Was there a question there?
A comment.
Okay, that's what I thought. Thank you, Representative Elkins. Next on my list, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I certainly appreciate trying to help small businesses, and I say that as a recovering small business owner having sold my business, I also come at this as a former mayor who went out of his way to make sure that how the city that I was mayor at spent money was always way out in the open, disclosed, heavily publicized, but not something that you could just I guess really award based on a less competitive situation. And the elevation from 250 to 750 seems like a pretty grandiose leap. And while I believe, some believe that it will make it easier to award these, I view this as a constriction of the pool of people who can view it. And by keeping projects smaller when I was mayor and making sure that we publicized them heavily, from my perspective, not only did the taxpayer have the ability to come and weigh in, because let's be honest, you're making it easier to spend more taxpayer money. And it could have a huge level of need and a high level of veracity and integrity. Allowing it to be published also triggers the opportunity for the taxpayer to view this. But, you know, again, I think that this really takes competitiveness out to a greater degree and minimizes the number of people. So I'm going to be voting no. Would hope that we can maybe talk through some of this, and I'd like to talk with the chair more, but I'm voting no for right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Question perhaps for Mr. Rosenfeld. I'm the last one listed with a question, so if others, please get on the list. If you could speak to the rationale in terms of the increase from the 250 to the 750, what led to that number? I mean, it is, to you know, some of the comments we heard, quite a significant increase. What was the rationale behind that particular new threshold?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The rationale was we looked at our total awards over a multi-year period, and saw the type and in particular we were looking at vertical construction projects, and we saw that the 750 would be on the higher end of the range for a smaller remodeling project. Remodeling projects really were, most of them were exceeding the 250. And so we had several that could have been in the 600 range. Some would go into the 700 range. Again, there was a span. And so the 750 reflects a tranche, if you will, that would capture most of our small to mid-sized projects. That was the rationale for that number.
Okay. That's helpful. Members, not seeing any additional member questions. With that, Chair Nelson, would you like to renew your motion to refer House File 1671 to the General Register? Chair Nelson, you're muted.
I muted myself. Thank you, members, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the lively discussion. And like I said, members, this is about allowing small businesses to get a piece of the pie so that and these small businesses, when they get a piece of the pie, they grow into larger businesses. Like it was stated here, because of the cost of vertical construction and wanting to be able to not have to break these contracts down into little pieces that are impractical. That's why we're trying to raise this amount. And with that, members, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1671 be referred to the General Register, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Chair Nelson renews his motion to refer House File 1671 to the General Register. Ms. Speck, if you would please take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
No.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski?
No.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Cleborn?
Aye.
Representative Kosnick?
Aye.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative New Brindley?
No.
Representative Pulowski?
Pulowski, aye.
Representative Quam?
Aye.
With a vote of 10 ayes and 3 nays, the motion prevails.
All right, thank you, members. That completes our agenda for today. Our next meeting will be Tuesday, March 16th. And with that, members, we are adjourned.